Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show is Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour, we will return to a subject that we have discussed before on this program. We'll be talking about nanotechnology. Now, this is a field that involves doing engineering on a very small scale. And it is the belief of many scientists that this field has great potential to change both our economy and the way that we live. Because at the nanoscale, materials that we know well can have very different properties, and that can make them very valuable for a wide range of products and tackling a wide range of problems. Well, this morning, we'll talk a little bit about what has been going on in the last year or so in this field here at the University of Illinois and in a larger sense. And we have two guests with us to talk. Irfan Ahmad, he is the executive director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the University of Illinois. He also happens to be acting assistant dean for research at the College of Engineering. Also here in the studio with us is Yi Liu. He is professor of chemistry at the University of Illinois and is one of a number of scientists on this campus that is interested in this kind of research. And we'll talk a little bit about specifically what he has done in his work. And they're both here available to answer questions, and we'll do their best. If folks would like to call in, we'll be happy to take your call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Is our number. We also do have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We also have email if you'd like to send in a question that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, joining the conversation is certainly a possibility. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
The center, your center, has been around now for, I think, about roughly speaking, a decade, I guess. Maybe it's more like 11 years or 12 years, the Center for Nanoscale Research. And the university has become a really leading place for that kind of research. When people first started to talk about nanotechnology, it seemed that we had scientists making, on the one hand, fairly expansive predictions as to what it would yield. And also, on the other hand, people very worried about the potential consequences. And I'm not exactly sure that either of the extremes has come to pass, although people continue to worry about the potential impact on the environment and health of nanoproducts. So having said all that, generally speaking, and I'll begin with Yi Liu, since you haven't been here on the program before, and we'll let Irfan go second. Tell me where you think now nanoscale research is.
Well, first of all, I think there's a misconception about everyone thought about nanomaterials is new. In fact, actually, nanomaterial itself is not new. Actually, it exists in nature and biology for many, many years. The only difference is that the researchers and scientists just recently has been able to using modern technology to be able to discover and see them using something like microscopy. Because it just, for example, in my own research, we discover in the biology, use a lot of beautiful nanoscale material for many, many years. Actually, we've been utilized, we just didn't know it was a nanoscale. I think that is the one big difference, is that it's not brand new in the sense. But on the other hand, it is new in that the scientist has been able to see this and be able to say, can I make something from cost-effectively, from grand scale, so that for utilized by human being to improve our life. I think that is new. Mm-hmm. So we're actually intentionally trying to, inspired by nature and biology, and trying to make materials similar but cost effectively and larger scales, and it can improve our life. I think that is a new. So in doing so, then there's always two sides of it. Because again, it's not something that, aliens have come out of nowhere. It is something we use every day. For example, let me give you an example. For example, the seashells and pearls, and those make beautiful materials at a nanoscale. And nature used to make them, in the ambient condition, we used to them for a long time. But the question is, it's very expensive, at least for pearls, and can we actually make something has a similar properties in a larger scale for something we can use? I think that's really, so therefore always a two side of it. Then on the one side is a beneficial side, but obviously because we're making something artificially mimicking nature, there are always things we can make mistakes and can be have unexpected consequences. We have to be careful about that.
Mm. So here, Ifran, is the issue that what happened was tools became available to us that we did not have before. We had tools that enabled us to see things that were very small that we could not have seen before. And that was really the big thing that then all the other innovations followed from.
Yeah, exactly. And so as you were very rightly from the onset gave a definition of nanotechnology, basically involving imaging. It's a length or a thickness scale for imaging, modeling, measuring, and manipulation of atoms. And as you said, I mean, so it's the manipulation at the atomic scale, where the properties of the materials are different or change as compared to the bulk material. So coming back to the question, so these tools started coming online since the late 80s. And so that's where the scientists could do and manipulate and look at material, characterize materials. These include the scanning tunneling microscope, atomic force microscope, scanning electron microscope, and all of these were recent the developments. And those have led to these the materials characterization, materials fabrication, and then for those applications in different areas.
Yeah. Another way I think that sometimes it's been explained, or I've seen it been explained in terms of basic definition, is that in the past, engineers, people who make things, have always had to work in a kind of top-down fashion. What we're being able to work on the nanoscale enables you to do is go the other direction and work from the bottom up. Theoretically, then, if you could, as nature does, take atoms and put them together atom by atom, you might do that in a way that it's not found in nature and thereby get something that behaves very differently. Having said all that, are people actually doing that? Are they actually building things by taking one atom and sticking it together with another one?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's what the chemists have been doing for many, many years. In atom by atom, we're making new molecules, and a lot of drugs, for example, are part of that. And so we're actually getting really better at making new molecules to make drugs that, you know, not necessarily, they're natural product that can be drugs. But now, because it's so expensive to make, so chemists have been making new drugs for a long time, but we don't call nanoscale because that is at the molecular level, we call it. And but on the other hand, the nanoscale is something above the 1 nanometer to about 100 nanometers. Those phenomena has not been fully explored. And so in other words, atom by atom building people have been trying for many years. But I think there's a new phenomenon in between the molecular scale and then bulk scale. And those scales has been unexplored. So that's exactly how it's been, many people have been doing, including outstanding people here at U of I, where people have been trying to see, can we put a nano cluster, make a nano particles, put them together in different ways. And the reason I'm saying this, because there are many applications. Obviously, it's just impossible to mention everything, outstanding work by many people in U of I and around the world. But one thing is just something related to my own research groups is that, for example, in terms of color changes, the reason is that because our natural light, the one we see, the color red, you know, green and blue and so on and so forth, they're in the nanometer scale. So when the light interact with the nanometer scale materials, they actually have a beautiful change of colors by simply changing the distances. So many people in the world, and including my own group, in trying to take advantage of that phenomenon so that they can actually use that as sensors for environmental detections. And also in medical diagnostic. In the old days, most people using organic dyes, you know, something like we buy the paint in a paint, you know, used to be just organic molecules that have a beautiful colors. But these nanomaterials has a very small scale, very small amount, but they have a much more intense color and changes of color depending on the interaction with the lights. So those are new kind of one good example, the nanomaterial, by rationally understanding it and utilizing that. Now we have, for example, dipstick test for detecting for bacteria, heavy metal ions, cancers, and viruses, so that we can actually utilize the nanomaterials that we would not have been able to do using a small organic molecule that we still build by atom, but now we're building on a nanometer scale.
Mm-hmm. What? Tell me, if from your, the area that you work in, the kind of research that you do, just give me an example of something that employs nanoscale technology.
So, some of the projects that I and some others on campus across the colleges have been working on, especially in the ag and food area, is detecting soybean rust spores, and again, to identifying these biomarkers, but using these biophotonic crystal sensors developed by colleagues, and being able to do that. Right now, most of this is done by taking samples and bringing back to the lab and then analyzing that. And so this is of a major concern to the USDA, being a soybean area that we are Midwest in, and generally speaking, as an export crop. So that has a lot of implications and repercussions if there's an outbreak of soybean rust spore. And with the climate change patterns that we see with the occurrence of hurricanes and so on and so forth, there's a potential for that to occur. There have been instances of soybean rust spores in Brazil and Argentina, and so there have been some spotting of those in Florida and other areas. So that's one key area. Other is integrating these wireless sensors for nitrate sensing. We had worked earlier on nitrate sensing, but now colleagues are working in trying to integrate these sensors and put it out in the field in a manner that you could have mapped the entire field and you can get a good sense of it. So you have like GIS maps where you have a yield map, you have the organic matter moisture content map, but then you have this added information in terms of what sort of nitrates are present. And you know, nitrates again cause runoff and can result in blue baby syndrome in the waterways, and even in our backyard in Vermilion County and in the Danville area, we see there's occurrence because of over-application of fertilizers and the like. The other one that we actually had a project with the USAID and working with the overseas partners was on using plant extracts for killing cancer cells. So there's a plant extract library, so you do a chemical analysis of that, and there's expertise available there, and then you use these with the biophotonic crystal sensors developed by colleagues here, and then test those that library through a high-throughput mechanisms, so you are able to identify which particular plant extract kill the cancer cells and which cause cell proliferation. And similarly, those could potentially be used for infectious diseases and the like. So, and then recently, more importantly, using these nanoparticles for encapsulation. So either as a transport mechanism for the delivery of pesticide, spray drift, and all these issues are big issues from an agriculture standpoint. So what we call it for conducting or carrying out environment-friendly agriculture, there's a role for nanotechnology. In this case, those can be utilized, including then if you come into food area, then for food packaging and the like. Mm.
Well, let me just very quickly introduce again our guest. Irfan Ahmad is Executive Director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. Yi Liu is Professor of Chemistry. We're talking some about nanoscience and technology and some of the work that's happening here at the University of Illinois. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you'd like to send us an email, send a question or comment that way. You certainly may. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I'm curious about this as people have voiced concern about potential impact of nanomaterials on human health and on the environment, whether just to what extent there are people who are doing research that ends up creating something that did not exist before. Does that really happen?
Of course, it does happen. When we try to mimic natures and we try to not only make something similar, but also we're trying to make some property that maybe even say more cost effectively, for example, in the case of a colorimetric sensor, even have an even bigger color change and so on and so forth. In creating so, yes, there's a possibility that we're creating something that not necessarily we at least we don't know aware of in the mm-hmm. nature. So that is always, for any new frontier research, it's always this unknowns. And definitely we're very careful, and there are a lot of researchers going on around the world, including U of I, in terms of studying the potential unexpected effects for those type of materials.
Yeah. That's the thing that I'm sure does concern some people. When you're dealing with something like this, a situation where you have produced something that you think did not exist in that form in the environment before, how do you go about answering the question, well, what happens when we put that in the environment, and is that likely to be a problem or not?
So that's where, NSF and other federal agencies have tried to focus on and say similarly encourage the researchers to what we call the societal implications of nanotechnology. What are the environmental implications of nanoparticles on the life? What is the life cycle of a nanoparticle? How long does it keeps aerosolized or goes into the water stream, and so on and so forth? So yes, so there is a concurrent effort in terms of actually studying those phenomena and seeing, because this is uncharted water that we are going into. So there are groups of researchers both at this campus and across the country who are engaged in those that sort of research. So it's a concurrent effort, and so when we encourage our faculty and graduate students, so when they are working in some of those areas, that there should be a concurrent discussion about the societal implications of that. And so we have reviewed some, and NIOSH, the Occupational Safety and Health, is really concerned about these from a worker standpoint, worker safety standpoint. And so the data is currently being accumulated, generated, and there have been some centers which were recently funded across the country who are exploring some of these issues as such. Including toxicity and others.
Because already there are, and I'm not sure to what extent people are aware of this, there already are a range of consumer products, maybe even things that people are using right now, that have nanoparticles or that employ nanotechnology. And it's a relatively young field, so one wonders how long it would take before you could actually make a determination that something would. It may be seen that initially it wouldn't seem like a problem, but then it might take time before you'd know whether it's a problem or not.
Yeah, I mean that's true, and that indeed is the case, as you said. So there are about 1,000 or so commercially available products out there. Your abrasion-proof sunglasses, and your tennis rackets, your tennis balls. And the like. I mean, and you keep on adding all of those, your nanotech materials for your stain-proof the slacks and other the garments. Mm-hmm. So, again, there is a continued effort to actually evaluate those as we go forward with these to see the what would be potential repercussion. Again, this is a new field, as you said, and so it will take a while to see the implication. As with any new technology, I mean, you would not know some of it until you have, just like, I mean, I would cite the example of the digital camera or the handheld, and then now the smartphones that we use. Now that has enabled us to take images or photos when we like and where we like. But then those have introduced new issues, like the privacy issues and all the issues that we have seen making on the news and all the stuff. Exactly, those were unheard of 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so but the question is that we continue to mitigate some of those issues, and we continue to have those discussions so that we are aware of it. And at the same time, it should not constrain the researcher to go about doing the research. Now, I mentioned earlier in my talks also, is that there are proponents of these technologies like nanotechnology that they think that it will solve the entire problems of the entire world, including food and hunger. And then there are others who want to institute a ban on nanotechnology research. But the truth is that there is some ground in between where this is to be treaded, and that should, because we see that there's light at the end of the tunnel, and with these areas, as I mentioned, agriculture and food and medical and pharma are the areas where it will have profound impact in terms of how we live and interact.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone who is listening in Champaign on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two exciting fields, your nanotechnology and genome sequencing. And what is the relationship between those two? For example, I've seen genes, so I know they can be photographed. And is it possible to actually also see and photograph with nanotechnology the makeup of the CAGT particles that are nucleoids, I guess, that make up genes?
Is that something you can answer?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Of course, there's a lot of work that's been going on in both areas, and there's definitely a lot of interaction and synergy between the two. The genome is just information, but how are we going to get that information into something practical? Because the gene only codes for something. And in order to understand those genes, because we know a lot of the code here, but what does it mean? What does it function to do? And we know many of them, but the majority of them, actually, we don't know what it means. We just have a code in there. What does it code? So therefore, nanotechnology, at least in one area of application, it allows us to actually to go in to find those product of those genes, for example, proteins, and so that we can know what they are doing. And then to do that, then we need a modern new technology, because it's just they're very small amount. We don't even know where to look for it. They're in the places in the cell, in the body. So those nanotechnology, imaging technology, sensing technology allow to actually to elucidate what these particular information, the function, the location, and then amount, and what did they do, and what's interaction with other already known parts of that. So that's one area of research in there. But to answer your second part of your question, and is it possible to actually do the other round? So that's exactly what actually my lab is interested in doing. Is we actually have some recent publication where we're able to show that actually the different sequence, different code, different combination of CA GTs actually give you a different kind of morphology and shapes of the nanomaterials. And if you have a one type of sequence, you got a spherical particle. But if you slightly change the DNA slightly, now we get actually beautiful stars or a prism or something in between that, what different thickness and so on and so forth. So there's actually a lot of unknown that we have not been able to explore. But this interaction between the biology, in particular genome and different DNA code, and the nanotechnology actually allow us. So in this case, so then you can use the DNA to influence the behavior and the growth of different materials, and then something that we have not seen using other type of materials. So again, a lot of synergy. This is only two examples of many that's going on.
Wow, that is exciting. You mentioned that you have a publication that shows this sort of thing. How does this get distributed? Publications?
Well, we go through the peer review process. So the first publication just appeared about a year ago, and by the called the Nano Letter, and then we have one that's going to appear pretty soon in another journal that's almost finished in the review process. So the in the most scientific publication, we go through, the writing and discovery and writing, and then go through peer review process by different type of journals, and then there will be anonymous review by expert in the field who consider not only the significant but also the quality and whether the result support the conclusion of that. And then that usually go through anywhere between 1 month to several months, and then we go back and forth and have to address the issue, and then that get accepted and published in the scientific
now,
journal.
Now, are there publications for just lay people to see some of this nanotechnology images, and what are some of the names of the publications for lay people?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I know Irfan probably have a more, but the one thing I like to read is Scientific America. So they usually have very readable materials for those type of materials. I know there are different kind of places like New York Times and other type of newspapers has a scientific sections. I like to read them. Those have a different, and also many different websites, including some of the website on EDUWISE site. I think Irfan probably know more about.
Yeah. So let me add here. So one of the things that you could do is to visit the CNST's website, which is nano.illinois.edu. And under that, you would see some of the faculty research. And then from there, you could go and look at individual researchers and look at their publications, which would have a title and all those details. And under that category, there is a host of other information, including publications. And we recently actually produced what we call it Nano at Illinois Research Faculty Handbook, which profiles 150-some researchers who are engaged in micro and nanotechnology research on campus. And that gives you a snapshot of what is happening on this campus and what is the range of activities and where the technologies are coming down the pipeline. The other one is at the national level, you could potentially go to nano.gov, G-O-V, and that's a National Nanotechnology Initiative's website, and there is basic information about what nanotechnology is, what it means, what are the applications, and so on and so forth. And, of course, there are lots of other websites which talk about nanotechnology as such.
Oh, excellent. Thank you very much. It's most exciting work.
All right. Thank you.
Very good.
Thanks.
We'll continue to talk with our guests, Irfan Ahmad and Yi Liu, about nanotechnology at the University of Illinois after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Daniels talks about starring as a cable news anchor in the new HBO series, The Newsroom. It was created by Aaron Sorkin, who also created The West Wing. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here Monday through Friday at 10 until noon. We have different topics every day. Tomorrow, in the first part of the show, the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She is professor of education at Harvard, is a sociologist by training. We'll be talking about a book that she's authored. The title of the book is Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free, and it takes a look at how people manage big life changes, big transition in their lives, which can be, of course, very difficult and stressful, but can be also very positive in terms of creating new possibilities for people in their lives. So that's tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. Also tomorrow, we will have a health topic for you, something that we occasionally do on the show. We have various physicians that talk about their areas of specialty, and our guest on Thursday at 11 o'clock will be Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. She's been here before to talk about her special interest in that part of the body. So if you have questions, we'd be certain to take them. We're here, as I say, from Monday through Friday, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of focus, we have as our guest Irfan Ahmad. He is the executive director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Also here in studio with us is Yi Liu. He is professor of chemistry, and we're talking about nanotechnology and some of the work that scientists here on this campus are doing. And as Professor Ahmad said, there are some 150 people here on this campus from different departments, different disciplines that are interested in applying nanotech and working on the nanoscale level to their own particular interests. And there is a book that's put out by the university that has all of them listed. And also, as he said, if you're interested in some of the work that's going on here at the center, you can go to their website, which is nano.illinois.edu. And we have a caller here, again, someone to bring into the conversation over in Belgium, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I have missed a portion of your show, so if you've talked this, please shove me off the air. But the question I have is, this technology, now, obviously by the name nano means it's extremely small, and I wonder if that might cause some kind of problems with the human genome or the human condition in that, you know, like DDT, when we had it, it looked pretty good at one time, but then we said, oh, DDT has a lot of other problems. Has that part of this technology been looked into and thought about?
Yes. I think any technology is always a positive and negative part. And there's many research going on in U of I and around the world supported by NIH and National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation. There's several centers around the U.S. here whose whole focus on study the unexpected consequences of nanomaterials. And they're using different kind of models, both computational as well as experimental approaches to study whether there's any short-term, medium-term, but more importantly, long-term effect of that. Yeah, there's active research going on right at the beginning of that, but definitely recently, there's definitely a lot of concern about that.
Has there been anything found to be detrimental at all?
Well, there's some. Based on what have I read is that when you use material that's potentially toxic, like also even the nanomaterial stage, it also can be toxic. And so, therefore, in a lot of research, including my own research, we're trying to use a biocompatible material to start with, and a more of an inert material, for example, gold as a starting material, and more importantly, like a protein and nucleic acid. As a molecule interact to assemble these ones. And these are more biocompatible, naturally biocompatible, and also many extract, like Dr. Ahmad mentioned earlier, about using the extract from the natural products. And so in those ways, then, we can minimize, we still do not know for long-term effect, but we can at least minimize the potential effect because they come from nature, and then we just put in a different way.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Sure. And that does certainly, the caller puts his finger on one of the things that I think people do get concerned about, that we are talking about things that are very small. Nanoparticles are small, and it's possible for them to enter the body in a variety of ways. They can be inhaled. They can be ingested. They may be absorbed through the skin. They maybe even can penetrate cells because they are so small, mm-hmm. and that there are certain things, carbon nanotubes, for example, there is concern that could be as much of a problem as asbestos is. So it's not, there is, it sounds as if there certainly is reason to be concerned mm-hmm. about the impact of some nanomaterials on human health.
Right. So on the other side, also, want to take advantage of that. For example, I'm also involved with several researchers at U of I, where we actually utilize that property to be able to deliver drugs because it's more effectively. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of drugs fail not because they're not effective to get to the site, but the problem that it's just harder to go through all the barriers, to go through that selectively into, for example, cancer cells and so on and so forth. So we're actually working with many different people from both a fundamental side and also using different experimental approaches. We're utilizing the nanomaterial as a way to be able to penetrate more effectively to the cancer cell, only kill the cancer cell, but not the regular cells. Hmm. I think there's a we can actually take advantage of that fact so we can actually can have a therapeutic effect using nanomaterials.
So, just like to add there, so our current approaches, in especially in cancer treatment, cancer research, as you know, it is of high importance to the National Cancer Institute and that instituted a nanotechnology cancer alliance across the country for doing some of this. So current approaches includes for cancer treatment is surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. But then there is the likelihood or there is the chance that you actually impact the healthy cells around the disease cells. And so nanotechnology offers the hope that you would have a targeted the delivery and that would actually permeate the cell. And that can be utilized as an advantage rather than a disadvantage. And you would have the nucleus of the cell where you would deliver those. And so those are being now currently active research areas, projects going on under this umbrella, both at this campus through the Midwest Cancer Nanotechnology Training Center and elsewhere around the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, questions are welcome, and all you need to do is call 333-9455 if you are in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along a question by email, you may do that as well, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit earlier about, I guess I started out with this idea that sort of in the abstract, that what you're doing is working at a very small scale, assembling things in novel ways so that theoretically you could build things atom by atom. I think that though you're mostly going at a scale a little bit bigger than that, rather than putting atoms together, I think most of the work is happening at the molecular level. Is that right? So you're still talking about small stuff, mm-hmm. but not building things atom by atom. So I guess I'm still wonder if you say if you have a particular substance that exists in nature, the pieces have come together in a certain way, and then what you can do is perhaps say, take those same pieces but put them together in a different way so that you get something that is new or that behaves differently. I wonder why it is that thing doesn't already exist. If it can exist, are there a lot of things that can exist but just don't, and nobody really knows why they don't?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. It's always our ability to be able to discover. For example, as I mentioned at the beginning of this program, you know, we saw nanomaterial, scale material, we're excited, but it's actually been there for many, many years in biology. Uh-huh. It's just the modern tools that give us abilities. So it's kind of a technology go hand in hand in terms of characterization tools that allow us to see a better, deeper, and more smaller scale, and also so it could be that we think it's new today, that we thought it's new, but maybe many years later we discover actually biology has it already in there. We just never had a chance to find it. I think that's a good possibility. And in fact, there are a lot of example like that, you know, we thought we made something new, but it's actually learned later that, you know, when we're using more advanced technologies and realize, okay, it's already existing in the nature mm-hmm. already.
So this is a very interesting idea to me that in fact we may be not, there are some cases where we're not making something that's completely new, and it did exist in that form in nature, we just didn't know it. Yeah, how common is that?
I'll give you an example of there's a material corn zein, a protein, so it occurs in corn. So that is now being used as a scaffold for regenerative medicine. So colleagues here working across the colleges of engineering and agriculture are working on making microfluidic devices using corn zein. So it becomes what we call it again, environment friendly, the agriculture or device, and instead of using polymers. So that really takes it to the next level, and you take something which already existed, but apply it in different applications. And so those are some of the areas that they come to mind. Going back to the previous questions, comments on the environmental issues. So our knowledge base is limited. And there is not enough data to be conclusive on those in terms of the broad ecological and population impact of some of these, and including the reproduction and impacts on biodiversity and so on and so forth. So these are topics of ongoing research. Now, how this is shaping up are the areas of research. So we have been mentioning agriculture and food and medicine, and in medicine also the individualized medicine. We talk about integrated devices. You have nanosensing devices which are integrated into a handheld device, which someday would be like your smartphone, like where you would take your measurements and go off and be on the road and still be able to do that and communicate wirelessly to your physician or to your nurse, and completely change the way we conduct the healthcare business currently. So, and then there is this in advanced manufacturing. And so with President Obama's initiatives on advanced manufacturing, so again, there is this role of nano manufacturing in being enabling us to, and creating our competitiveness and lead in the world as a global leaders in terms of using these technologies to bring back manufacturing jobs. But these would not be the traditional manufacturing jobs that we are talking about. So we are talking about using digital prototyping. We are talking about where you, instead of having a full assembly line of manufacturing, you could alter the manufacturing on a customized basis, and so without incurring additional costs. Just like if you go to on Amazon and you have a customized the feedback system pertaining to your interest. So in this case, I mean, if somebody wants to have different specifications for a product and so on and so forth, those could be done on the fly without totally retooling the entire production line. So that's an interest area that, again, is of interest to the state of Illinois as such, and of course, to the University of Illinois. And University of Illinois is building on the one of the nanomanufacturing centers which came about in 2003-2004 from the NSF, which is in its 8th or 9th year right now, and have developed a lot of new technologies in e-jet and inkjet printing and the like. Those would then take it to the next level. And this is where our national leadership can be established, and as a country, or the global leadership would be established. And that's how you could potentially bring back some of the manufacturing jobs to the state. And so that's where you would have both food companies and the like, ag and the ag companies, ag machinery companies, John Deere and the Caterpillars and the like, and then the, and host of Abbotts and the Baxters.
So you think that there's really potential for, say, for our community or for our region, not just to be the source of research that could lead to new products, but that actually the making of the products, there's no reason why we couldn't also, in addition to doing the laboratory work, then take that thing and take it through the rest of the development stages to the point that we actually have a finished product.
Yeah, and so as you had outlined right from the get-go, the center's role has been not only to promote or facilitate research on the campus, but education, mm-hmm. but then the training. So when we talk about the training, so we're talking about the training of the next generation workforce. So we have several the NSF-funded grants like IGERT, Integrative Graduate Education Research Traineeship, where you're talking about biologists being trained on fabrication techniques and the engineers being trained on cell culture techniques, and you're bringing these. So you're creating a new generation of workers, scientists, and engineers. And then also some of these manufacturing the issues will be dealt by technicians. And so that's where we are just engaging in discussions with community colleges like Parkland and others in terms of developing a curriculum where you would bring about those changes and train these folks in some of the tools that we were mentioning, like atomic force microscope, scanning electron microscope, and the like. And so these centers enable us to do all of that stuff. And we are currently partnering in an outreach manner also, so not only talking about the current graduate students, but also to building this pipeline. We know that there is no steady stream of students coming through to the science and engineering disciplines, and so our focus is, and to do that, we have actually been setting up our shop there at the Urbana Farmers Market, where someday you would see on Saturday Nano at Illinois. So there the kids are coming in, they're playing, and they're looking at some of the things that can be done and get them excited into this, and also to communicate to the general public what potential nanotechnology holds, and then what are the issues on both the pros and the cons and the like. And then innovation-based entrepreneurship. So that is another area where, I mean, Yee's company and several other faculty members, and there was a paradigm shift on the part of this campus, but a vision that led through in terms of establishing a research park, which now has at least 8 or 10 micro/nanotechnology companies on campus, either started by faculty members and or graduate students, and are doing well. And a couple of them actually have graduated, so to speak, and are doing very well. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a whole lot of activity which is going on, which is centered on this campus, and which has made it a national leader because of some of these ingredients which were put together, set forward by the campus vision and the College of Engineering vision in terms of bringing all these folks together. And when they started sitting together, they created new ideas, and we can see in the form of the recent centers that came about.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk a little bit about something that you've been involved in that's gone all the way from the research and laboratory
stage to the actual the development stage?
Sure, yeah. So when we start off, actually, we are all interested in fundamental research. But when we made a further discovery, we actually have very exciting new result, one of which I mentioned earlier, where we take advantage of the very interesting color changes and very intense color change, even more so than the dye that we use in regular paint. Mm-hmm. So that we actually take advantage of that and couple with a biomolecule like a nucleic acid I mentioned earlier, so that these nucleic acids have special properties that can recognize the target, for example, for heavy metal ion for environmental detection, or for bacteria or cancers, for medical diagnostic, and they actually very, very interesting color changes and very intense and in a short period of time. So we're actually able to file the patent, and then we actually license it to a local startup called Underlights, and they're actually a part of a research park. And they're actually in the process of marketing these tools where it's just like a regular pH paper where you can test the pH of the swimming pool or the soil level, but instead of detecting pH changes, we can actually now detect very sensitively for environmental detection for environmental toxin like heavy metal ions or some of the interesting diseases like a cancer.
Yeah, that's really interesting that it has this this research and particularly these testing implications, where I think there have been a number of people involved in this work, so that you could detect toxins. You could detect, disease-producing agents. You could do all that with a relatively inexpensive device that would be easy to take into the field, where you could get your sample and you could do your test and you could get a result right away, rather than doing something where you have to take your sample and you send it somebody and they have to do it in their laboratory and it takes a long time to get the results and then you have to send it back. That's one of the things that seems that this technology can enable you to do. And when you want to get an answer right away, mm-hmm. That can be really important.
Yeah, that's where lab-on-chip technologies and the like, and they are being tested for HIV and AIDS in Africa right now in the diagnostics. And they're looking at CD4 cells, but I mean for water, also contamination and the like. So those are some of the areas that I mean actually are key in terms of advancing the state of research. But then taking the research from the bench to the commercial arena, and that's where we actually established through the NSF the Center for Agriculture, Biomedical, and Pharmaceutical Nanotechnology, working with industry to actually come up with the technologies which translate into commercial arena quickly. That includes startups and that includes the Fortune 500 companies, and that's exactly the sort of endeavor. So there's a multi-pronged approach towards it, and with the resource constraint base at the state level, you have to actually be creative enough to create these resources, opportunities where you would work with multitude of the partners to advance the research, but then also the training component. So among the upcoming events we are having is a summer institute, which we have done over the last several years, hands-on training from July 30th to August 10th, where we bring in folks from across the country and across the campus and several people from outside the country. And then also one of the key events is the light-emitting diode, where there's a 50th anniversary, which was developed here by Professor Nick Holinek, coming on October 24 and 26, which has totally transformed the way we live and interact, and is a multi-billion-dollar industry in itself, and its role potentially in water purification and the like. And so I'm just naming one or two of these technologies, but I'm saying that there's a whole lot going on, and that's where people to explore, to go visit these nano@illinois.edu website, and or there's a repository in answer to the question from an earlier caller, is a nanohub.org, and that's a repository of all the material that is generated for here on this campus and elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left. I guess I find myself, not being a scientist, easily going back to the environmental impact kind of questions. Because that's the thing that I think about most, and I can understand the desire to get products developed and into the marketplace quickly. I guess I'm still find myself wondering about whether whether that really gives you the opportunity to assess potential impact and whether you might nobody would want to be in the position of having something and have it be available and having it cause a problem and then say, gosh, we shouldn't have done that in the first place. I mean, can you really balance those two things, especially if you have something that you think is beneficial? It's a good thing. You'd like to have it available as quickly as possible. How you strike your balance between getting something that you think is potentially very useful and making sure that you're not in 5 years or 10 years going to see some problem with that.
So yeah, so to that question, the center that I mentioned, the NSF IUCRC Industry University Cooperative Research Center, so we have on non-paying members, which includes the FDA, the USDA, and potentially the EPA, who are on the table as new technologies or developments are being going on. And so it's in the interest of the companies and the academics that we are engaging them while the development process is going on. So, yes, I mean, the question is very pertinent, but we have been trying to address those. And then there are several efforts across the country, as I mentioned, going on. And also on this campus, there's a water purification center also is engaged in some of those and are also working in Africa in some of those areas. And so we are looking at all of those details.
Another thing we also try to mitigate this potential risk is to, as I mentioned earlier, not only use a biocompatible starting material, but also the product is biodegradable. So that's mm-hmm. once you make the product and once you use it, it's disposed in the biodegradable way so that it will not have a long-term, it will not be a nano scale or material anymore after being used. Mm-hmm. So that's another way we will not have this in the environment for many, many long time. It's only in the box when you use it and dispose in the degradable way. Mm.
And you're beginning with the assumption that if you have a material that is benign, mm-hmm. that if you make some small changes in it to give it some different properties, that even though you have something that has different properties, it's still going to be as benign as it was when you started out?
Not necessarily, but at least it's a safer starting point. Okay. And then there still could be potential one. But again, we also make sure it's disposed properly in the biodegradable way so they will not persist in the environment in that form for many, many years.
Right. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say for now. We'll bring the conversation to a close. I'm sure that on the station we'll be getting back to this one way or another as time goes along. For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, Irfan Ahmad. He's Executive Director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the U of I, and Yi Liu, he's Professor of Chemistry. And again, if you want to find out more about what they're doing there at the center, you might go to their website, which is nano.illinois.edu. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.